don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on December 10th, 2017, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel and Nate joined me to talk about Bernie Sanders' worker ownership bill and about the failure of the railgun and other defense spending boondoggles. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again in studio this week, as usual, is Nate. Hey, Nate.
Great to be here, Bill.
And joining us on the line, as usual, from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to be doing a half episode this week for scheduling reasons at WVUD. And then just to preview ahead, there will be an episode next week. Then there will be 2 weeks where we do not do episodes because of it being the Christmas and New Year weeks and everything, and it's just too confusing and complicated for us to be able to record. And then we'll presumably be back in January with more episodes. But we've got a half episode this week, so let's jump right into it. Nate, what are we talking about first this week?
Well, so we have looked at, there's a sort of parallel effort both here in the United States and also in Britain to promote worker ownership of businesses. So there was a bill introduced, just by several Democratic senators, including both senators from Vermont, Sanders and Leahy, and also Kirsten Gillibrand, and also Maggie Hassan from New Hampshire. And basically what it would do is, it's called the Worker Ownership Readiness and Knowledge Act. And what it would do is direct about $45 million towards funding state-level employee ownership centers. So provide training and technical assistance to current and prospective worker owners. And the other part, the second piece of legislation attached to it, would establish something called the U.S. Employee Ownership Bank. And what it would do is provide a fund to give out low-interest rate loans and financial assistance to workers who want to buy out their businesses where they currently work and then incorporate them as, say, a worker-owned cooperatives, or also potentially establish employee stock ownership plans. So where employees get a little bit of the ownership stake in the company through stocks and things like that.
I think the bank idea is particularly interesting because there have been many cases where a company is, you know, going to go bankrupt or whatever, or the owner decides to close it or something like that, and the workers are sort of at the mercy of these larger forces. But if they had the opportunity to buy out the company that they work for and run it themselves, you know, that could open some new possibilities. Whether or not you're, you know, a socialist who wants the workers to own the means of production, it's an interesting concept and idea. And I think a lot of people, you know, in some of these rural areas or heartland areas, the cities, they might be interested in, you know, being able to buy out their factory or something like that.
Right. So I'm reading from the article in These Times, and it points out that a lot of this came out of the closure of the Youngstown Steel and Tube Factory in 1977, which was sort of a, you know, early indicator of the type of a deindustrialization and, you know, going towards the Reagan era that now Trump that we've seen coming through the Rust Belt there. But workers attempted to seize the plant and run it cooperatively, apparently, in the run-up to the closure. Things ultimately failed, but people were inspired by this. And 10 years later, in 87, they created the Ohio Employee Ownership Center. And that's helped many companies, up to 90 already, have become employee-owned. creating around 15,000 employee owners just in Ohio alone. So potentially that model could spread to other states and, you know, get sort of people talking about, oh, we need a Democrat or workplace democracy or economic democracy, put terms like that sort of into the lexicon. And maybe, you know, that could be a way towards reaching people that, you know, they're just working at the factory and they want to have some sort of a return from it or some sort of joint ownership that makes it feel like, oh, I'm actually participating in something rather than just having my labor exploited. So
right. And I think a lot of the folks who listen to our show and folks that we know in general are kind of, you know, skeptical of the possibilities for capitalism going forward. So this is, you know, some of this might not be that the democracy, the economic democracy and workplace democracy stuff, you know, some of them, it may appeal to them in just the general sense of the workers should govern everything democratically and so forth. But there are also, you know, self-styled democratic capitalists who think that capitalism, you know, the sort of narrowly concentrated hyper-capital model that we have right now is no good, but that there might be room for a democratically governed capitalism that distributes things a lot more evenly among various workers. Rachel, what were your thoughts on these pieces of legislation?
It's a good plan. I mean, we've seen this sort of model work very successfully in Mondragon, Spain, where there is a huge network of made up of smaller co-ops. They seem to ride the 2008 global recession a lot better than surrounding areas in other countries. So I think it empowers the worker. My favorite supermarket, Winco Foods, is employee owned, and the employees just seem a lot happier because they feel that ownership of their work and their pride in their work. So I think it. Even from like a money-making point of view, it's more empowering for the workers and it makes them more productive.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a very good sort of model. And as you mentioned, things in Spain, there are also just here in the United States, a lot of things that you may just sort of see like Cabot Cheese or REI. Those are also co-ops. I think also Publix supermarkets and Wawa convenience have also offered the employee stock ownership program. So sort of see this model is spreading somewhat here. Also, I wanted to mention Jeremy Corbyn in the United Kingdom also promoted sort of in the run-up to the election there a right to own program, giving workers facing a change of ownership or closure of a firm the right of first refusal, I guess, to put forward together a worker-owned alternative. And he looking for regional development banks that would help out with this process, and also looking for a way to factor in automation and robots into all of this and have the robots be owned and controlled by workers rather than bosses as everything gets further automated and as the gig economy gets more entrenched. There's also mentioned looking at replacing things like Uber with cooperatives. So,
right. As always, I mean, the devil is in the details on any of these things, because there are ways that you could do this that are very beneficial to ordinary people, and there are ways that you could do this that are very exploitative. Certainly, some of the capitalists who push this model, as opposed to pushing it from the left, are thinking of it in the terms of, like, almost turning everyone into like a small business owner, where they end up then sacrificing themselves and their lives and their work-life balance and everything in order to keep the company going, because now they don't just work for a faceless corporation, they are the corporation. And so, you know, they start feeling like, oh, I have to go, you know, put in that extra overtime without extra pay because I got to keep the company floating and that sort of thing. You know, so that's like an exploitative model of this. And similarly, I think there's concerns over some of this gig economy stuff, because they try to make everyone like say, oh, you're working for yourself, you know, you're not working for us, that sort of thing. So it's, there's a risk here if it's not done right. But there are also ways that you can do this that are, you know, totally fair and equitable and really actually empowering people in a positive way.
Yeah, to quote from Corbyn, he says, the technology of the digital age should empower us both as workers and as consumers, allowing us to cooperate on a scale that wasn't possible in the past. As he points out, has given rein to a more rapacious and exploitative form of capitalism. So yeah, we definitely have to think about this. And as you mentioned, people pushing forward some things like this or universal basic income and things like that has to be viewed somewhat skeptically, I think, especially if they're coming at it from a different angle. So,
right. And obviously, I mean, there, you know, the robots thing that you mentioned briefly, like that's something that we have to consider going forward in general, whether it's this model or handled through another way. You know, there are a lot of folks saying like, hey, it's not really fair if the, you know, owners of these companies replace all their workers with robots and then reap the, you know, enormous profits off of no longer having to pay labor costs, like that maybe we should have a model that diverts those new savings and profits to the workers that are being replaced, or create some sort of fund for them or something like that. And so there are all sorts of questions that are going to really force this issue to keep being brought up. Rachel?
Yeah, I would like to point out that Uber has had a really awful year PR-wise. And I think if we treated Uber drivers more as a cooperative where they had more of a say in how Uber is run and collect, as Jeremy Corbyn said, collectively controlling their futures with profits shared or reinvested, I think it could really turn things around for Uber and definitely make them a better choice when you're considering ride sharing options.
I think there are also ride sharing options that have done the cooperative model. I'm just looking here. I think there's something called People's Ride in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and there are sort of other on a smaller local scale, but obviously, you know, nothing compares to the size of Uber or like Lyft or something like that. So
to give a sense of some of these proposals, obviously the Sanders proposal is sort of more on the socialist, social democratic end of the spectrum for a proposal like this. You know, I've talked about previously on the show before, so I won't belabor it too much. Hillary Clinton in 2015 had a proposal involving profit sharing that was sort of hailed by what I would term to be the reformist end of the liberal, you know, the market liberals. That feel like, oh, we have to do something to keep people happy because the system isn't really working for them. But it's always going to be pretty light solutions. I was not particularly impressed by it because it was something along the lines of like, you know, we'll give you a tax break if you share some of the profits with your employees, which, I mean, presumably the tax, like you're giving money to the corporation to give money to their workers. It just seems kind of like a pretty roundabout way of doing things. Again, it always is going to depend on the details of these things, but like there is some sort of spectrum of support for the, you know, something along these lines. So the other thing that you wanted to talk about this week on our half episode is about defense spending and defense contractor shenanigans, things like that, in light of the recent announcement of the railgun being doomed to the scrap heap, I guess. What's the story there? What do we need to know?
Yeah, so I guess a couple, maybe about 6 months or so ago, the military did a public test of its railgun that they have been developing at the cost of $500 million. You know, usually when you talk about military procurement, you want to round up a couple 10 times usually. But so they did a big test of it, and apparently it works. It can shoot projectiles really far and fast, I guess. But the thing is, it doesn't look like they're actually going to even use it or put it on a ship. There were talk that they were going to put it on these new naval Zumwalt destroyers, of which there were about three made, and they actually had to scale back the number that they initially wanted because it's not really cost-effective or anything like that and potentially does not accomplish the strategic missions that it was designed for. But it could potentially have enough power to power this large railgun, except looks like the military is not going to use it for that purpose, and it looks like they're shifting money around into lasers, into other types of programs, and they're just going to end up using the hypervelocity projectiles and just use them in normal other guns. So yeah, they that looks like railgun's not going to be used. Railgun bullets will just be used in everything else, I guess. So that's the, we spent $500 million to develop new projectiles, I guess. That's what's going on there.
So what is sort of the broader significance of this?
Yeah, I think it sort of speaks, as I mentioned, with the Zumwalts themselves. There's a lot of questions going forward to what is the military actually focusing on? What are the strategic missions we're actually trying to fulfill? There's all, of course, all the questions around, say, the F-35 fighter in which all of these, there are all the technological problems, and where they're not, you know, there's a question of, is this actually strategically necessary in order to have any sort of battle? You know, it sort of seems like the F-35 designed for against a peer competitor like the Chinese, but is that actually going to be effective against them? And so, you know, setting aside all the cost overruns and such there, they're just the question of what are these actually for? What are the Zumwalts actually for? They also had the littoral combat ships, which are sort of supposed to be like drone bases and things like that. And they ended up cutting back the number of those that were initially planned. So, you know, this sort of is natural and to be expected, I guess, but it was interesting to see, like, okay, they've got this railgun, they're going to mount it on this new, like, high-tech stealth destroyer, and then that just never ends up happening, and it is very strange, so it seems like
it's definitely something
massive
that,
waste of money.
That came up a lot in articles for years, like, I remember...
They were hyping,
you know,
it up for a long time.
Really hyping up this railgun stuff, which was seemed kind of useless or whatever. Do you also see it as sort of a... in the same vein with the discussions recently about missile defense issues, you know, Donald Trump clearly not really understanding how missile shields work or don't work, but also clearly being misled the same way that many people in the media are essentially misled, in terms of like, oh yeah, you know, no problem. We'll just knock these missiles out of the sky and then everything will be fine. And it's usually like not actually that effective, just like, you know, the F-35s and things like that. There's a lot of these big projects that are supposed to be, you know, a salvation of some particular problem.
Yeah,
and then they
don't. Yeah, sort of the Star Wars syndrome. And interestingly, actually, I believe that the military in one of their documents said that in the future, the railgun could technically be used to shoot down missiles and sort of have that as its use instead of the sort of the successor to like the battleship cannon or something like that. But I mean, this is probably, in the grand scheme of things, will be a setback of maybe a couple decades. But I imagine, you know, in 50 years or whatever, all of our ships and weapons will have, and our walking battle tanks, they'll all have railguns and things like that. So, I mean, this is probably, they sunk a lot of money into the technology. They're getting the projectile out of it. They're not really getting anything useful out of it, doesn't seem like. But the military is not lacking for money. They can get all the money they want. So they're just trying it out, building giant guns to shoot, and that's basically what is happening.
Rachel, your thoughts?
Well, I reading these articles, it's so ridiculous that they're talking about a valley of death between the process of research and development and actually bringing these to the military. So it's you just see all this wasted time and wasted money that is just coming out of the bottomless pit that is military funding, and you just can't help but think that so many other more worthy projects are losing funding because of this like bottomless pit of military funding. And it's kind of frustrating to see these projects like the F-35 and this project just getting money thrown at it and nothing really comes to fruition from it.
And they never really talk about the debt question of this as well. I mean, whenever there's a program that could actually benefit people, it seems like, oh, what's the cost going to be? You know, we're driving up the debt. And even when we talk about tax bill and things like that, that's sort of a focus there. But when we talk about the military, that never, ever comes up, really. So,
yeah, I mean, I think Rachel is right to put it that way in terms of like this bottomless pit of money for defense spending that's available for that and not available for anything else. I guess I'm reminded a little bit of some of these other projects that we hear about from the private sector. Well, I mean, this is partly private sector as well, you know, to the extent that they're private companies, but like, oh, you know, we're going to build flying cars and hyperloops and, you know, rockets that land a certain way. Like, there's all these sort of things that get hyped up, and some of them will get done, and some of them will get done eventually, if not now, et cetera. But like, some of this is just somebody managed to persuade the government to give them a bunch of money to like fund their sci-fi novel development into reality. Like, it's that kind of like silliness of, you know, and not really addressing the question like, well, do we need these literal combat ships? Like, what are we going to use them for? Do we need these rail guns? What are we going to use them for? Like,
yeah.
That all of that is kind of secondary to this, like, oh, let's build cool tech
cool.
And stuff.
It's
yeah.
Science fiction-y. But then, yeah, they usually have to cut back the number because there was going to be 24 Zumwalts initially created up at the Bath Iron Works up there in Maine, but it was reduced down to 3. So, Yeah, so now there's only three. So we got three of these little weird boats running around. They don't really do anything, but we have them, so it's great.
Yeah,
it's cool.
And if they run into any spare parts problems, you know, crash into each other or something, we need to make some repairs. It's gonna be a little tricky if there's only three of them, but who knows? The other thing that I'm you know reminded of, which I think is a good note to kind of go out on with this, is just that like in the past, you know, several decades ago or quite a few decades ago, a lot of defense spending, as bad and terrible as it was, and to the, you know, often very bad aims that it was being put toward, people could credibly make an argument that, oh, it's, you know, creating jobs in various parts of the country. You know, they would spread out the development through all these different states to try to get as many members of Congress and senators on board. You know, but you could credibly argue, oh, well, at least there's all these people working at these factories making them and stuff like that. And they tend not to outsource this stuff for the most part or offshore it. For security reasons, although some of that I think has changed as well. But one of the like really big changes that has happened is that now, you know, they automated a lot of that production the same way that like automobile production or whatever other types of factories got automated. And the as well, the executive compensation went way up. So a lot of the defense spending from the government is basically going to like a few, you know, the CEO and the CFO and the CTO and like that, you know, that sort of thing. They're all getting paid some, you know, tens of millions of dollars or whatever per year. And then they just buy some more yachts or put it in an offshore bank or buy a bunch more mansions or whatever. Like none of that is stimulating the economy in any way. So you can't even argue that this is some sort of like vital aggregate demand being fueled by government purchases that, you know, is going to have this ripple effect through the economy to help a lot of people, because it really isn't. It's very few workers at most of the levels left, even in research and development, you know, because Rachel was talking about a lot of this stuff getting held up at that phase and never really breaking past the R&D phase. Even those folks, like a lot of these engineers, they're not necessarily that well paid. They might be well paid relative to some things, but there aren't that many of them. And they, you know, they're not getting, put it this way, they're certainly not getting paid very much if you do it as a ratio comparison to how much the executives are making. So a lot of this defense spending is increasingly concentrated. It's not being dispersed out the way it used to be. So even if you set aside all of the moral concerns and considerations regarding this massive military industrial complex stuff, you know, that Eisenhower and others warned about, it's not actually really having even the alleged positives that it used to have. So I think that's something that we, you know, need to keep in mind as well. It's not just that it's taking away money that we could be using for other more important things that help our country, but it's also, you know, it's basically just lining a few more rich guys' pockets the way that the rest of the system is going these days, right?
Right. Eric Prince could afford to buy another house, and yet they couldn't afford armor for vehicles in the Iraq theater. So it's kind of ridiculous how privatized our military has become money-wise, and yet we have all these citizens, 18 to 21 year olds, going out and fighting without proper equipment.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point too. Even if you set aside the question of social programs, they're not even spending it on the, you know, the military that we have to keep a lot of the troops safe. It's just like, you know, how much can a private corporate executive make, whatever. And there's lots of reporting coming out now about Eric Prince's various latest proposals for privatizing the war in Afghanistan for rare earth metals. And there was a proposal out of Whitefish, Montana, which we've talked about a few times recently on the show. But there was a report there that there was a company that was bidding to try to create a privately outsourced intelligence gathering and rendition organization that would basically go around the world kidnapping people to bring them to the United States so that the U.S. government didn't have to kidnap them before interrogation. Which I don't think they're probably going to actually go through with that proposal, just because they clearly have moved on to just droning people from the sky and asking questions later. But, you know, it's alarming nonetheless that this is the sort of direction that a lot of this spending is going, whether it's rail guns or private kidnap forces.
Yeah, and I think a lot more money will go into things like drones, to the point where eventually they're going to become automated and just potentially make the kill decisions by themselves, which is a scary thought, but that is a possibility we should be aware of.
A big research and development thing going on right now is trying to train drones and other sort of smart bombs to, like, drop on a convoy and recognize these are the civilian cars and these are the cars with militants in them and stuff like that. So a very sort of bleak and alarming future coming down the pipeline there. And I guess we'll leave it in that. Again, as a reminder, half episode this week for some scheduling reasons at WVUD. We will be back, however, with a full episode next week at our usual time on Tuesdays at noon, or released on Tuesdays on arsenalfordemocracy.com if you're not listening to it directly on WVUD. So, Rachel, thank you so much for being here this week to talk about these issues.
It's always a pleasure, Bill.
And Nate, thanks for being here in studio.
Thanks, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFD Radio or email AFDradio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on arsenalfordemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.